Welcome to the Conservative Book Club podcast, the best in conservative books, politics, and culture. And now your host, Chris Malagisi.
Hello, and thank you for joining the Conservative Book Club's weekly podcast bonus episode series, where you'll find the right books for the right readers. I'm your host, Chris Malagisi, editor-in-chief of the Conservative Book Club, now the largest political book club in the country. Our special guest today, whom we'll get to momentarily, is none other than best-selling author H.W. Crocker III, who is also the vice president and executive editor of Regnery Publishing, and who is a former longtime editor of the Conservative Book Club. And he's here to talk about his new exciting book, Armstrong, the Custer of the West series, published by Regnery Fiction. So each week on the podcast, we thoughtfully discuss books, movies, culture, and conservatism, and interview noteworthy authors and public leaders. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Player FM, and now even Alexa. And you can subscribe easily to the podcast on conservativebookclub.com/subscribe. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and rating. And a special thank you to Stephen Roken, who left an iTunes podcast review saying, "The CBC podcast offers many interesting topics, and it is a great place for information. God bless the USA and the Conservative Book Club." And God bless you, Stephen, for the awesome review, and thank you for subscribing to the CBC podcast. And CBC podcast listeners, make sure to leave a review on iTunes, as we just might read it on the air. All right, so the moment you've been waiting for, we're truly delighted to have our very special guest with us today, H.W. Crocker III, or we'll call him Harry for the interview, who goes by the whose new book was just released titled Armstrong, the Custer of the West series, a fun fictional story about what if Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer, you know, the Custer from Custer's Last Stand, had survived the Battle of Little Bighorn. And this book is already getting huge buzz, including from bestseller author Stephen Kuntz, who says that the book is droll satire. This is the West as it might have been if the Sioux had saved us. And Rob Long, Emmy and Golden Globe nominated screenwriter of Cheers, and who's also a National Review writer, says, "Crocker has created a hilarious hero for the ages. Armstrong rides through the old West setting right the wrongs and setting the wrong the rights in a very funny cascade of satire, history, and even patriotism." And just a little background on Harry. He helped refound Regnery Publishing in Washington, D.C. as its editor-in-chief in 1986, a position he held for 5 years before becoming speechwriter to then-Governor Pete Wilson of California. He rejoined Regnery in 1995 and has led the editorial team through a succession of best-selling seasons. A former editorial writer for the San Diego Union, he has written for many outlets, including National Review, The American Spectator, The Washington Times, and the National Catholic Register, and is the author of half a dozen books, including the best-selling Robert E. Lee on Leadership, Triumph, The Power and Glory of the Catholic Church, and one of my personal favorites, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Civil War, as well as the award-winning novel The Old Limey. And today he currently lives on the site of a former Confederate encampment in Northern Virginia. Harry, congratulations on your new book, and welcome back to the Conservative Book Club.
Thank you very much, Chris.
So let's first start off by perhaps reminding our podcast listeners, who exactly was Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer?
Custer is a great American figure, because Custer, he came from fairly obscure backgrounds. His father was a small-time farmer and blacksmith. But he works his way to get to West Point, where he graduates last in his class. But he graduates last in his class not because he's not very bright, but because he's a prankster. And he gets in trouble all the time pulling these practical jokes on his fellow cadets. And in fact, on the day when his class graduates, Custer is court-martialed because two cadets get into a fist fight, and he, being an upperclassman, should be breaking it up, but instead he decides to make sure there's a fair fight and acts as referee. So he actually saw his class graduating while he was behind bars in the brig. But he goes straight from West Point to the front. He goes straight from the West Point to the Civil War. The Civil War has just broken out. Mm-hmm. Custer was born in Ohio, raised in Michigan, and was always very loyal. That's one of the qualities of Custer. He's loyal to his family, his friends, and his nation. He believed, he swore a oath of loyalty to the Constitution, which could not be broken by the Civil War, even though many of his best friends at West Point were Southerners. He himself was a conservative Democrat. He liked their cavalier spirit, And in fact, during the war, I think it's one of the greatest stories about Custer, is that he was a very boyish, fun-loving, likable guy. During the war, he actually goes to a Confederate officer's wedding at a plantation house in Virginia and stands as best man for him wearing his Union blue while his friend is wearing his Confederate gray. And Custer being Custer, he hangs around afterwards and flirts with the Southern belles.
Of course, yes.
But he was also, people, I think, neglect that he was not just this sort of cavalier. He was actually a soldier. He was, at the time, the youngest general in the Union Army. He was a brigadier general at the age of 23. He ends the war as a major general. He was extremely physically courageous. He was a great tactician. He was a great scout. He was great he was used by McClellan very early on in the war. And McClellan actually was one of his patrons. He recognized Custer's, not just his courage, but his ability to read force movements. And he was just an instinctive cavalry commander. Leading from the front, he wore a sort of self-styled uniform, which made him a big target for sharpshooters. But also, he wanted to let his men see, here I am, front and center, follow me, boys. Mm-hmm. Or follow me, Wolverines, because we had the Michigan Brigade at one point in the war. And the Confederacy had a big advantage in cavalry for the first part of the war. Mm-hmm. Not because of numbers, but because they were better at it. Mm-hmm. But Custer is one of the first commanders, if not the first, to smash that that supremacy and defeats Jeb Stuart. He defeats Jeb Stuart, in fact, at Gettysburg.
Yeah, let's talk about Gettysburg, because a lot of people know Custer through Pickett's Charge and all that he did in that battle. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Custer actually, one of the potential goats, if you're a Confederate sympathizer for the Confederate defeat at Gettysburg, is Stuart, because Stuart goes rampaging around doing Stuart-type things. Mm-hmm. He's supposed to be the eyes and ears of Lee's army. Lee has no idea where his army is. He has no idea where the Union forces are around him. That's Stuart's job. But Stuart's conducting raids because it's more glamorous. Mm-hmm, when Stuart arrives on the battlefield, though, it is at one of many crucial moments in the battle, and he is confronted in this clash of cavalry by, among other officers, Custer, who's hanging back to fight him. And in this brutal fighting, Custer sees the Confederate troopers off and arguably protects the Union line in what could have been a vulnerable mm-hmm. moment. But one of the things also about Custer is that not only was he, you need to remember that Custer was forever sympathetic to Southerners, but he also waged total war against them. At the same time, he maintained throughout the war good relationships with his fellow Confederate, or his fellow officers who'd been at West Point with him, but now were mm-hmm. the gray. So much so that he would hail them across the battle line sometimes, or go visit them, or deliver newspapers to them. Or, you know, he was part of Sheridan's force raiding the Shenandoah. He even visited a mother of a Confederate that he had treated well as a captive. Mm-hmm. And she gave him some mementos. That's no small thing, because we forget that the Civil War, at least in the South, was fought against civilians too. This was a brutal conflict. Mm-hmm. But Custer managed to sail through it, A, saying, I'd love to have a battle every day, and B, managing to maintain friendships on both sides. And this was true also during the Indian Wars. Custer, I think in a lot of the popular imagination, especially on the left, is seen as a genocidal Indian killer. And of course, the war against the Indians was also a total war. Phil Sheridan realized that the way you have to fight the Indians is to attack their villages.
Well, before getting into this, I just want to make sure that we let our listeners know. So at the end of the Civil War, Custer is considered a hero. He goes back home, but then he's quickly asked to come back.
Custer leaves the war as a major general, but like many after the war, of course, they're decommissioning officers. Uh-huh. And Custer is sort of a loose end. He tried to do other things. Eventually, he does become actually a writer. He writes and he considers some business interests and whatnot. And he loves the theater. He loves going to New York mm-hmm. to go watch the stage with his wife, of whom that's also a great story. Their romance is a wonderful lifelong story. But Custer was meant to be a soldier. When he comes back to the Union Army, he comes back, like many officers, has to take a cut in his rank. Mm-hmm. He also has certain political problems because Custer, being a conservative Democrat, was now beholden to commanders-in-chief who were Republicans. Mm-hmm. And so there's a little bit of conflict, in part because Custer was potentially a Democratic nominee for president. He liked to talk about politics. He was inept at it, and he really should have stayed, and I think he would have stayed, actually, in the saddle leading men. But because of his celebrity, his name was bruited about as a potential candidate, and one of his issues might have been corruption, because the Grant administration was very mm-hmm. corrupt, and Custer was upset about the way the Indian traders out west were corrupt. One of those people whose corruption he exposed was actually related to Grant.
So he's recruited to fight and lead a brigade in the Indian Wars.
In the Indian Wars. He also did, he actually had duty in Reconstruction, which he mm-hmm. hated. It was not very, not he nor his wife liked that sort of duty. But once he got at the open plains, mm-hmm. this is much more Custer territory, in part because, and this is getting back to his sympathy for his enemies, Custer said, look, if I were an Indian, I would not want to be in reservation. I want to be out here. I would want to live the life of an Indian. He actually, just as he appreciated Southerners, he appreciated Indians. He loved his Indian scouts. He loved hunting. He loved animals. He loved the outdoors. In fact, the animal issue is another thing that's worth bringing up, because Custer had sort of the St. Francis of Assisi sort of power over animals. He loved horses. He loved dogs. He kept a field mouse in his inkstand on the field for a while. They all loved him too. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I take some of these aspects of Custer, his love of and authority over animals, his devotion to duty, his devotion to his wife, his cavalier spirit, and exaggerate them for comic effect, so that the book is meant to be completely comic, completely an adventure story, completely an action story that you can read and enjoy. Somebody called it a dangerous book for dads. It's sort of politically incorrect, but you can also pass it on to your older
and
boys.
And people should know that the cover of this is of Colonel Custer with a tattoo on his arm, very muscular arms, born to ride on it too. So, no. Well, let's talk about the book. So, let's set this up. Talk about Custer's last stand, but apparently not his last stand in your book.
Yeah, well, now, Custer's last stand is one of those moments in American history that just about everybody knows. And Custer, as a historical figure, is someone who just about everybody knows, in part because, like Teddy Roosevelt, he's a little bit of a walking caricature of himself. mm-hmm. You think of TR with his glasses and his big teeth and his dynamic manner. You think of Custer with the flowing blonde locks and charging in the battle and whatnot. But the Little Bighorn battle is also extremely controversial. People who get really into the battle are always arguing about it and whether Custer was foolhardy or whether he was betrayed in some way by his subordinate officers who didn't like him mm-hmm. Or who were incompetent. But there's a lot of mystery about it because it's a massacre and you don't actually have a lot of, you don't have eyewitness testimony that is entirely reliable. Mm-hmm. So it sort of sets this up perfectly where you can have this sort of what if Custer were spirited away from the battlefield in the case of the book by this white woman who's been captured by an Indian mm-hmm. and made his sort of wife. She gets him off the battlefield for purposes of her own, as get explicated in the course of the book. So I thought, A, this is kind of a wonderful historical what if. B, it sets up for a wonderful, I hope, adventure story that's funny at the same time. And though I don't want to freight the book with undue weight, because it's meant to be sheer entertainment, which you could all use a lot more now, I think. Mm-hmm. But the book also has a little bit of a serious purpose, because I am upset I'm worried about the way there is this sort of war in American history. On the very day that we are taping this interview at the University of North Carolina, they pulled down a statue of what's called Silent Sam, which was a statue erected in 1913 to honor the students at the University of North Carolina who had served in the Confederate Army. So it's a war memorial. It's a memorial commemorating people who served or who died. This sort of iconoclastic attitude, which we've seen all over the place, obviously, strikes me as extremely dangerous. It will not end, it has not ended, with just taking on the Confederacy. And it is astonishing to me that here a Custer is sort of exemplar, a man who actually could have fought in this war, a war that saw more than 600,000 Americans die, could treat his former opponents with more magnanimity than we can arouse today, or many of us can arouse today. That strikes me as really, really bad. I actually wrote a piece for the American Spectator which said that America's next Civil War will be worse than the first one. And it was because of this. It seems to me that, as Lincoln famously said, that this division was tragic. And this is the way that Americans used to understand this war. Mm-hmm. Americans used to understand this war until seemingly just yesterday, that it was like an American Iliad with heroes on both sides. And it was, you know, Teddy Roosevelt mentioned this a minute ago. When Teddy Roosevelt was president, Teddy Roosevelt's mother came from the South. Teddy Roosevelt's father came from the North. Teddy Roosevelt had boyhood memories of the Civil War. Teddy Roosevelt gave a speech when he was president saying, "That's great, we all came together. I'm a total Lincoln diehard." I'm paraphrasing, obviously. But, he said, you know, we can take pride as Americans for those who served with valor in the blue and in the gray, for those who served with Grant and with Lee, because both fought for the right as they saw the light and were American heroes. And this was the thing. These people were not regarded as people portray them now as sort of proto-Nazis. No, they were fellow Americans. That's how people saw them then. And it's, you know, there is more true history in sometimes in novels. There's actually a fair bit of true history in Armstrong, but in novels that like Killer Angels or or Gone with the Wind. That book won the Pulitzer Prize. People who dismiss it as Harlequin romance or just an apologia for the old South are dead wrong. That is real history in that book. And losing this sort of sympathetic, empathetic understanding of America as a reality lived by individual history, American people, not as a sort of ideological thing, is being lost, which I think is a very, very dangerous thing.
And I want to get back to that in a second. We're with Harry Crocker, or H.W. Crocker III, author of Armstrong, the Custer of the West series. And real quickly, everyone, we need to take an obscene profit break here, but we want to thank our sponsor for today's episode, Regnery Publishing, who will soon be releasing Bradley J. Berzer's new book, In Defense of Andrew Jackson. As many of you know, President Trump has two presidential portraits in the Oval Office, one being George Washington and the other Andrew Jackson. Many historians believe that Trump is the Jackson of our time, leading a revolution against the political establishment in a most unorthodox way. But Jackson has been a very controversial figure, mostly known for his treatment of Native Americans and almost bankrupting the country over the Bank of America crisis. Is historical revisionism at work here, though? And are historians getting this wrong? To find out, read Bradley Berzer's new book coming out on September 11th, In Defense of Andrew Jackson. And you can pre-order your copy today by visiting conservativebookclub.com. We're here with Harry Crocker, author of the new book, Armstrong, the Custer of the West series. Harry, let's continue the what we were just talking about before about the Confederate monuments in particular. Why is this bad that these statues are coming down? A lot of people say, well, you know, they represent just people who are pro-slavery. Is that an accurate portrayal of those statues and what they represent, or is there more to it?
I think there's much more to it. I mean, I'll tell you what. A friend of mine was just in Baltimore, and he stumbled across. He didn't mean to go there, but he stumbled across these plinths where statues of Lee and Stonewall Jackson used to be. It was recently removed, or maybe removed a year ago. But you look at it, and what's striking is the inscription, some of which some vandal has tried to chip away, but it refers to them as Christian heroes. And we forget, you know, all this slavery, racism, bad. Well, yes, well, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, I mean, Thomas Jefferson owned slaves, George Washington owned slaves. If slavery is going to be the thing that tears us all down, you can't have been a slave owner and be a remarkable person in American history, I think we're in big trouble. You've seen Stephen Austin. Now, Austin, Texas might have to be renamed.
Yeah.
This is absurd. You know, Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee, they were touched by slavery, yes, but not very deeply. I mean, Robert E. Lee freed all his slaves before the Emancipation Proclamation took effect. Mm-hmm. Stonewall Jackson held a schoolroom for slaves, taught them to read, brought them to church. And we lose this sort of human sense of who these people are. Robert E. Lee wrote a famous letter. It was written around Christmas time, 4 years or so before the war, in which he said that, you know, few people will say that anything, that slavery is anything other than an evil. But all enlightened people know this. The question for men like Lee was, how do you get rid of it? Just as it was for Thomas Jefferson. We have this wolf by the ears. What do we do? Mm-hmm. And you know, Lee's answer was, we don't solve this problem by going to war over it or by force. We decide this problem by persuasion. That's how Americans do things. And when people say it's all about slavery, up to a point, North and South were divided by this issue, among other issues, also the tariffs and all sort of things. Mm-hmm. We need to remember, too, that the states of the Upper South, including Virginia, where Lee and Jackson are from, don't secede immediately. They secede after Lincoln calls on those states to raise troops to subjugate their fellow Southern states. That's when they leave the Union. So mm-hmm. the motive issue is, are we going to use force against our fellow Americans for these people? Sometimes I like to put it this way. If California, my home state, were to secede tomorrow.
It wouldn't be necessarily a bad thing.
Well, how many of us, though, would think it'd be a good thing to blockade Los Angeles and San Francisco and San Diego and bomb their ports, bomb their cities, invade? I think this would be an extraordinarily weird mm-hmm. turn of events and not a one to be. Or if Scotland had chosen for its referendum to leave, Lee said, look, a union that can only be held together by swords and bayonets has no charm for me. He believed, and many people of his time believed, that the union, which had been ratified by the states, should be a voluntary association, not held together by force. And he thought it was a tragedy. He didn't want to leave the union. But when his state left, he said, look, I cannot consent. And more or less quoting here, mm-hmm. to raise my sword against my family, my home, my native state. Save in defense of Virginia, I will raise my sword against none. That strikes me as a very human mm-hmm. And very heroic position to take that I think, really, I mean, in the past, has elicited a lot more sympathy, that people understood this is a tragedy with good people on both sides and trapped in a very difficult situation.
Like Custer. And For the book, and I definitely want to get back to this too a little bit, give our listeners a little preview of some of the fun stuff that happens in the book. I mean, I know you talk about in here what happens if he becomes a gun for hire, and what if he made common cause with a troop of can-can dancers, Chinese acrobats, an eye patch wearing rebel card sharp, and a multilingual Crow Scout. Give us a little preview of what exactly is in these 10 chapters of this
book. Well, again, some of this is vaguely true, or at least aspects of it are, but not the details there. But it plays on these things of Custer did love the theater. He was a very dramatic in his own mm-hmm. life. So throwing him in with these professional entertainers is a stretch, but it plays off of what Custer thought of those people. His relationship with his Crow Scout is very much like, again, exaggerated, but sort of like his mm-hmm. relationship with his real scouts. The Confederate card sharp, who is many people's favorite character, the former Confederate veteran, he's supposed to be just a character, but if you want to paint some more important stuff about him, it does sort of represent Custer's feelings of reconciliation, lack of estrangement, and hatred for the South. And he becomes a do-gooder in the book. He actually rescues this town called Bloody Gulch, Montana, from the tyranny of a very evil man with very evil designs. And there's a treasure involved, and there's all sorts of complications and good stuff involved.
So will there be a sequel? Will this become the Jack Ryan of the 1800 series?
So we hope. I challenge your members, because if the first book succeeds, yes. And the idea is to take Custer throughout this part of American history from one adventure to the next, which I think would be great fun. And, you know, in its own entertaining way, slightly educational. But I think, yeah, I'd love to do that. But it's all dependent, as these things are, on commerce and how the first book does.
Absolutely. Well, we've got a Facebook question from Hank Ayers, who wants to know, H.W. Crocker III, or Harry, what inspired you about Custer? Why, out of all the characters that came out of the Civil War, do you like Custer and decided to choose him for your series?
Well, he's flamboyant. I find him incredibly likable. And I think he's been gotten a bum rap out of history, because a lot of his critics consider him arrogant, stupid, reckless. And part of that, he had critics in his own time, but they were largely people who were jealous of his success. Mm-hmm. But I think if you research his life, you find out this is actually a really good guy, a really admirable guy, a guy who devoted his life to his country. And it galls me again to see how people look at his death. His tragic death. Again, here we have a tragedy. When he dies at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, he dies with two of his brothers.
Two of his brothers, yeah, that's right.
He dies with his young nephew, who's named after him. He dies with his brother-in-law, who's known as the Adonis of the 7th Cavalry, because he's an incredibly handsome man. It is a really heroic but tragic battle. And these people say, well, Custer had it coming. Well, there used to be a slogan, you know, in the 70s, Custer died for your sins. You know, I hate this disparagement of people that we should admire. And I think it is both a individual, a human, and a historical injustice to look at these people, a man like Custer, who devotes his entire life to the service of his country, to be, he killed Indians. Forget about him. And this is part of this thing with this whole war on history and on the Confederacy. It's not just Confederates. Here's George Armstrong Custer, a Union officer, a Union general. And yet, I've been telling folks, last year there was a Sonic commercial, that fast food chain Sonic. Harmless, totally goofy commercial. One of the guys is dressed up like Custer. He's talking to his friend. And there's a little joke about Custer. That was on TV for no more than a week before it was yanked, because the very appearance of Custer or the mention of his name was considered offensive. That's absurd. That is completely absurd. And if all of our history is going to be something we can't talk about, or that we're supposed to condemn, that everything before, say, 2008 was the dark ages of racism, sexism, and genocide, we're in deep trouble as a country. We need to recapture these folks. And again, I don't mean to freight this book with any too much weight, because it is meant to be entertainment. But I would relish the idea that this book could help bring us back to what used to be every American boy's birthright, was to look back on America's past with a sense of, wow, those are heroes, and with an affectionate look at it. When I was growing up in the 60s, I watched a lot of Westerns, and virtually every, it's basically, it's usually the winning of the West. It's like a great thing. It's a good thing. And Indians are held up as, wow, they're really brave. Every kid wanted to be an Indian. You're playing Cowboys and Indians. So you like both sides, like Custer did. But you see it as a triumph of, it's a great thing. It's a great adventure. But a lot of those guys who are moving West are, guess what? Former Confederate officers, too, or enlisted men, who are seen as good Americans. There are some great scenes in John Ford Western, which celebrate the U.S. cavalry, and how the Confederate guys who are part of have been reintegrated into the army, how John Wayne is always the former Union guy, or not always, but he's usually a former Union officer, pays his respects to his Confederate comrades now in federal blue. So I would just wish we could get back this idea of American history as a hero story, because it is, and we regard it in terms of individual personal dramas, the sort of thing you get from a book, the sort of thing you get from human history, and not this ridiculous Soviet agitational propaganda comic book version of, oh, well, back in the past, mostly Nazis, proto-Nazis, racists, and these guys were not quite so bad who fought them, but gosh, all of American history was pretty awful, which is very seductive to a lot of young people, and I think, because it flatters them. Mm-hmm. It flatters them that we are so much more enlightened than all those people of the past. That, you know, that's a dangerous sort of solipsistic, narcissistic, whatever you want to call it. It's very, very bad. Cicero said famously that to not know history is to remain a child. I actually think that's wrong. Not to know history is to be stupid, yes, but children are naturally curious and inquisitive, and they learn very quickly. And you know, putting yourself in someone else's shoes, empathy, sympathy. We are losing those things. We are losing that, what I think are our prime human qualities. And I think, you know, it's especially hard for conservatives maybe because so much of, practically everything on TV or in the movies or in fiction and in your bookstore comes from the left. It portrays this, a lot of these, I think, hateful and wrong ideas. And, you know, we all wish, gosh, I wish there were some conservative movies, I wish there were conservative TV shows. Well, they were in the past, but they were just naturally so. They weren't self-consciously so. They weren't, you know, oh, this is a conservative movie. Yeah. It was just assumed. And I would like, again, not to give this book too much freight to carry, but I would like this book to be like that. This is a book that is naturally conservative because it portrays the truth. And the conservative view of human nature and history is true. But you don't have to be like self-consciously thinking, oh, there's a conservative point, or there's a conservative point. It's just there. It just is.
I once was told by Rob Long that good storytelling is conservatism. It's understanding the true nature of human nature and being able to tell that story. And CBC members, we should heed the warning of H.W. Crocker III. And if you want to win the war against American history, you should buy Armstrong, the Custer of the West series book. Today, it just was released, and you can also purchase it on conservativebookclub.com. Harry, thank you so much for joining us today at the Conservative Book Club podcast. Welcome back as a former editor of the Conservative Book Club. I'm trying to fill very big shoes here in this position after your
very
tenure.
Very big boots. I wear a cowboy boots every day.
I don't have boots on today, but Harry, thank you so much for joining us today. And CBC members, if you like what you hear, definitely leave us a rating and review on iTunes. And if it's great, we'll read it on the air. And we really do appreciate your feedback and appreciate you listening. And we do take your questions. So join our Facebook and Twitter pages too, where you can submit them each and every week. Thanks again, Harry, for joining us. And congrats again on all your success.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Conservative Book Club podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your regular dose of all things conservative. You can do that by going to conservativebookclub.com/subscribe. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast on your favorite platform so we can bring you the best conservative content possible. See you next time at the Conservative Book Club podcast.